probably weren't involved too much, except for the early days, which I was not too well informed on, the evolution of the coming of the von Braun group. See, he came to Washington with Abe Silverstein, organized the new space agency. Maybe you want to just sort of preface this with your recollections. What these chaps need now is the headquarters perspective. You know, they're down there in this arsenal-minded, very competent group, well-structured and line-channeled and all that, and they've had some problems in putting the story together. As you know, with the funding and many of the basic decisions were NASA-wide evolved in the process through the headquarters. So maybe you can preface this with what do you think they would need to appreciate you were writing the Saturn story. Is that a good way to put it, Roger? Just to get started.
If I were writing the Saturn story, I'd probably look for another job. I mean, not Saturn. If I were writing history, I'd probably look for another job, see. I'm not a historian. And I don't... seriously, my concern here is I want to be as helpful as I can. Is I don't keep journals. I have not knowing what you want to talk about, I have not and probably don't have accessibility. Everything's probably in dead storage that I could refresh myself on in any details. Well, I don't really know how to advise you on what ought to be included in an approach development of a Saturn history.
Well, what was the view of the Saturn one, you see, which brought the Von Braun?
Well, I was going to say that from my view, we had a lot of elements here that, in a sense, just growed like Topsy. In a sense, of course, were very much guided simultaneously. In the growth. We had the Saturn I program already underway by ARPA. And I'm not sure I can recall at this time what ARPA even had in mind as a potential end use of the... Nonetheless, they had a vehicle. First stage, but it was... Okay. So we had that. We did have the capability represented by the Development Operation Division at Huntsville, at the Arsenal, that had produced the Redstones and Jupiters and whatnot. I was not on the NACA survey team that looked at Marshall for potential incorporation. I was on a West Coast team that looked at JPL and China Lake and Point Magoo and...
the whole country was surveyed.
Yeah, White Sands. There was another team that looked at, Fort Monmouth and several East Coast sands, including Von Braun's team. So I can't speak to that, and I say NACA, because this was done in the summer. It's done in August of 58. Or NASA formally was organized. But I do know the recommendation at that time, there were two recommendations that were adopted. One is that the Army contract with JPL ought to be transferred to NASA, and we ought to acquire basically JPL as a laboratory. And second recommendation that the Development Operation Division, Brenner, operated, ought to be transferred at Huntsville. And of course, this was resisted in that period, as I'm sure you're well aware, was resisted by Medeiros and the Army because they still had visions of being a missile power in the total force structure. And so they said no thank you in 1958. And then in 1959, they lost the inter-service roles and missions battle with the Air Force, and it decided that the Air Force would be responsible for all missiles. And so in the fall of 59, as I recall, they came back to NASA and said, hey, would you still be interested in acquiring Dr. Von Braun? Because it looks like we're not going to be able to justify really keeping him for the Army. There isn't going to be any missile role for the Army. And then I was involved in one of the teams that went down and arranged for the physical transfer of DOD to NASA in that period from then until the summer of 60.
Could you go into that a little bit, some of the problems that you faced during that period and some of the considerations that might have come up?
Well, the
long-range plan begins.
Well, I wasn't in long-range planning at that time. I was, I was still over in Abe's development, Space Flight Development Division.
Upper Stage Committee on Upper Stages.
No, I wasn't a participant in that. No, my involvement was more with, the mechanics, who, how many, what kind were going to be involved in the transfer. What physical facilities at the Redstone site would be part of the transfer, what wouldn't. I frankly, just offhand, don't remember any really noteworthy things. We went down and then tried to determine. See, I was at that time trying to organize for Abe a program control for the whole program, and that's the way I got involved here, is okay, what are the numbers and the kinds and the costs that we're going to get associated with, not from strictly the administrative side, that was handled by all secret and people from the administration. And I don't recall any terribly noteworthy things. I can recall one thing, and frankly, I wouldn't mind telling you, but I'm not sure I'd even want it on the tape. I think that experience showed that Von Braun did have a team down there that had reasonable to good management. I don't know how much of it was Werner's personal involvement or how much of it was Eberhard Ries and Harry Gorman.
That's part of the history.
I don't remember whether Harry Gorman was there at the time. But at any rate, it did turn out that they had sort of the internal management capabilities, I think. But at any rate, we acquired this asset of people and this, what I guess I could fairly say, it was at that time maybe a dubious asset of the S-1 stage, not knowing, of course, at that time what the S-1 stage would be used for. We had some problems, had some problems anyhow, in technical crossing of the minds between Silverstein and Von Braun, in their earlier meetings on Defense Department, science boards and so forth. Abe had, of course, pushed, and we'd put into development the F-1 engine back in January of 1959 without any mission, but based on parametric studies, it said something like 1.5 million pounds looked like it would be very useful, either singly or in combination. Werner seemed to always operate, I say Werner, now I'm talking about Huntsville, seemed to operate on the philosophy that let's do it with things that we know something about. So, you know, if you have to cluster 8 engines. If, God forbid, it should be 20 engines, cluster 20 engines, but don't develop a whole new engine to replace pieces of these. And there had been, had already been some crossing of technical viewpoints, even on the configuration of the S-1 stage. Abe had felt they should go for some bigger engines, and fewer of them, and Von Braun felt that, no, we know this engine very well, and we should stay with this engine.
Even clustering was controversial, though.
Well, clustering was controversial, as I say.
Why did they have such high confidence? I never could understand.
I think their confidence was that they could control the bird so that they wouldn't release until they had X number of engines, you know, say one engine out as a maximum, before they'd ever release it.
You think they knew the Russians worked in this area?
As far as I know, I have no reason to believe that they did. Now, I don't know if they did or not, but I have no reason to believe. There was I know the Russian booster was a big surprise, I think, to most everybody when it was finally revealed in all of its...
They had some sort of informal...
Yeah. But at any rate, really what it represented was a philosophy, I think, one could say, their philosophy was stay with pieces, components that we know, and even if they get pretty complicated in the aggregate, we can handle them. And basically, we can handle them because we don't have to release until we know they're firing. And once they're firing, the odds of them cutting out just intermittently is pretty low. So they felt they were fairly safe grounds. I think Abe more represented the other viewpoint, so that's an awfully untidy technical way of going about a solution and build yourself a big engine and replace all these small engines. That was the philosophy that led to the F1. Don't know how we'll use it, but sometime we're going to need thrusts in the order of 1.5 or multiples of 1.5 million pounds, and we'd do better to have it in one chamber than in trying to make it up out of 300,000-pound chambers, sort of thing. So we'd had that kind of a technical conflict. We did have the F1 engine under development, and we had this S1 stage, but you know, it wasn't obvious. As you say, it wasn't a vehicle, it was a stage. It wasn't obvious just what the hell it should be used for.
How tense was this stage?
Oh, I wouldn't say there was, I wouldn't describe it as tense. It represented two differing philosophies, and Abe was never one to...
Some writers.
Oh, I don't think there was any, knowing Abe as I did, I don't think there was anything personal in
Abe.
He could be
very antagonizing, but it was never...
Well, he could be very abrasive, because Abe is one of those people that is very intolerent of...
Incompetence,
mediocrity, or lack of thinking something out. I mean, worked with Abe for many years. I knew his position was, no matter how good a thing you brought in and said, here's what we ought to do, Abe would always say, go back and think about it, and you'll find the fourth iteration is probably going to be not only different, but a heck of a lot better. But this looks all right, but there's probably going to be some better way if you go back and think about it again and again and again and again. You can refine this in your mind, and don't jump to early conclusions. And Abe always tended to be relatively intolerant of people who said, there's only one way to do it. What he said is, well, you've only thought of one way. You haven't really thought your problem through. So he has this kind of abrasive thing, but I don't think it was attached to any personal. In fact, I know that Abe personally admired what Werner, as a team leader, was able to accomplish. Because at that time, we were in the throes of using the Redstones and the Jupiters. And I know Abe indicated that, you know, you had to give them credit, that they made something that flew. But philosophically, he didn't necessarily agree that they were on the right engineering track when it came to complexity. Well, I don't know what more. The thing turned around, of course, until Apollo was became a project, and we began to try to detail what the hell Saturn really was.
Is that where you got into costing?
Well, we got into it. Initially, we didn't try to cost down really to the detail level. We had done costing on whole project concepts with just sort of representative, if you had an engine or if you had a stage booster that looked about thus and so, it would take about thus and such to develop it. But this was before we had nailed down whether we were talking about an S2, an S3, an S5, an S6, an S8, you know, in terms of number of engines. we didn't know. At one point, it looked like we might want to go to as much as 12 million pounds of takeoff thrust as one possibility. And here again, there was, I think, as I recall, there was some technical disagreement about whether or not we should really incorporate hydrogen in the upper stages. Abe felt very strongly that we should, although we had never flown any hydrogen stage, obviously. Felt very much that we should, because it would result in a lower thrust and a lower complexity for the takeoff stage. And I believe, although I'm not positive of this, that again, the Huntsville team tended to lean towards, let's stay with RPs or fuels that we're familiar with and accept the penalty in terms of a larger first stage, more complex
that
first stage.
Stronger on the ARPA NASA committee on first stages. Ben said A pretty well strong armed the rest of the committee of the ARPA NASA.
Is that right?
In December 59, on the liquid hydrogen stage.
I know he felt very strongly that that's the direction we must go, and part of it was just, again, technical neatness, so to speak, but part of it was resulting reduction in complexity of the lower stages. That why go around incorporating engines that you didn't really need, making a more complex first stage in order to fly a lower ISP second stage.
Do you remember any specific instances of opposition towards using high energy upper stages from Huntsville Group?
No, I couldn't cite any specifics, but I do recall that sort of in keeping with this general feeling that you stay with what you know something about, that they were not at all sure that we were ready to commit ourselves to an upper stage that had to be hydrogen.
First Apollo was the second lunar which you would have used the Saturn 1 or the
C-1. Well, no, you say the first Apollo,
the second lunar.
We use the word Apollo, but I differentiate between Apollo as a concept and Apollo as a mission. Mm-hmm. We had been looking as an outgrowth of the Mercury. See, Gemini didn't exist at this time. An outgrowth of Mercury at what were the next steps that one would do in the manned flight area, and it seemed rather obvious that you wouldn't just try to fly more and more around the Earth, but the next thing is go out and fly around the Moon. And it had been studied in that form, and it resulted in not too unreasonable a booster requirement if you wanted to simply do that.
That's when Ostrander really came in with the off the launch.
Yeah, that was in, I guess it was in the fall of 59, wasn't it, that Don, I forget even.
Did Milt Rosen go through this with you yesterday?
Not a great
the
off
the launch vehicle.
We talked about funding.
Silverstein had everything, all programs.
Yeah, he had all programs there for
you. That's open the door. And I guess the off the launch vehicles was the first major delineation from Abe's.
Yeah, that was the first major split, was to separate the launch vehicles from the missions themselves. It was originally space flight development, and then I forget what they called it when they made that split. There was launch vehicles, and then there was.
George Lowe was the whole office of manned space flight.
Yeah.
Until John Disher came in to help with the planning phase. I believe that was mid-59.
Yeah, that's right. He was the whole office.
Well, we don't want to test your memory here.
Well, I wouldn't want to.
Where next do you come into this Saturn story then?
Well, the next thing that I remember. As a really concrete thing on the Saturn story is, as we developed the concept for Apollo and knew that we were going to have something like a Saturn V, or a Saturn V by that point, for the actual landing on the Moon, and therefore we had to have an S2 and an S4B stage, we were already then committed to an S4 stage for the Saturn 1. And the one thing that I can remember, and I don't know the exact, couldn't give you the exact date on this, but there was a presentation to Glennon in which Ostrander and the Marshall people came up and said, we really ought to introduce the S-1B into the series. That the S-1 wouldn't hack it for Earth orbital missions, really, and that we ought to go into this S-1B, both to give Earth orbital capability before you could have the whole S-5 vehicle, and also to give, very importantly, some flight experience on this hydrogen stage, this S-4B stage. That's a way to get some flight experience before we get the commitment of the whole Saturn V vehicle. And they presented a rationale, and the thing I recall is that they presented their funding estimates sort of along this line, that they said, well, gee, we've already got the S-4B under contract. So basically, you know, that doesn't cost us anything. We've already got the S-1 under development. So basically, that doesn't cost us anything. Now, we know there are going to have to be some mods to the S-1 in order to accommodate the S-4B. There'll be some structural mods and this sort of thing. And they estimated, I'm not sure of the number of vehicles, but I think it was of the order of 8 or 10 Saturn 1B launch vehicles could be had in the program for something like $110 or $120 million over and above the development of the S-4B stage and the S-1 stage, both of which were already underway. So for an incremental cost of about $110 or $121 million, they said we could have, I'm not sure if it was a 12 S-1Bs, but some number. And I know there was, in those days, already we were beginning to raise questions about the validity of some of the cost projections, because though we weren't that far into the program, we were far enough in a lot of projects to know that initial cost estimates tend to be pretty low. But we didn't have any real developed experience to go back and say where. But I recall this because it turned out, of course, we spent almost $900 million on the development that is allocated as peculiar R&D costs for the Saturn 1D vehicles that we bought, over and above the development of the S-4B stage and the S-1 family.
And at that time period, Mercury was...
Mercury was...
Sort of a funny...
Well, Mercury was beginning...
I mean, as far as the estimate and then...
Yes, except, you know, Mercury never really got that far out of line. The original funding estimates for the spacecraft contract were about $30 million. That's the basis on which we projected the cost at the time we left the contract. It was the government's estimate. And that came out to be something like $120 million. So, you know, by a factor, yeah, it was a factor of four, but in absolute dollars, it didn't quite. But well, it was beginning to creep up. We knew it was going up. It was later on that we, after the Gemini program, that we really began to realize the magnifying factor that we're going to put in some of these cost estimates. But that came later.
You talked about this increase from around 100 to around 900 million. Mm-hmm. Do you remember some of the factors involved? The general thing that you tended to underestimate, or where there's a lot of problems?
No, I think the... there was just a whole bunch of things, and I know Werner is quoted as saying, in some context at some time, that when he came into NASA, he, in essence, he knew how to go to the moon, but he didn't know what $1 billion was.
Uh-huh.
And that's about it. Everybody was naive as hell about how much effort it took and why costs ran. I can tell you some of the problems that we had that we know that were not strictly technical problems at all. We made cost estimates on what has subsequently turned out to be a very naive viewpoint, and that is that you could break the overall task down into component tasks, and that you could develop this component. And then, from a costing viewpoint, you said, okay, it's developed, it's accepted here, no more cost on that contract, when in fact what we find out is that we don't have confidence, and therefore this is delivered, say, 3 years before flight, we've got to keep that team on, or at least elements of that team on, until we actually use it, because if anything goes wrong 3 years hence, we got to have the people available who designed and developed and built it. And so instead of your costs running to zero, they stay up at a very substantial level. Now you multiply this through hundreds or thousands of contractors, and it's easy to see where, my God, just the recognition, or the, not the recognition, the reality of this, as compared with the concept that this guy is through development at this point, and therefore I have no further costs, there's contributes to a very large measure to these kinds of costs. And I think that is, there were, of course, technical problems you ran into. But my viewpoint, as much as anything, it was just simply, we didn't appreciate that you have, you're dealing now with essentially a captive industry, or at least within a company, a captive division that has to be set up wholly for your purposes, because they're not, they're far beyond the normal commercial channels. You can't just throw something into a commercial line and pull it out. So you have to have them set up, anything from an S&ID division like North American did, to whole divisions or whatever you call them within Rocketdyne, just to do our stuff, and we're the only customer. And you know, instead of going down to the grocery store and saying I can buy a can of peas for 27 cents, you suddenly realize, yeah, but I own the grocery store and I'm the only customer at the grocery store, and therefore I've got to pay for the costs of keeping that grocery store. And it's not 27 cents a can anymore, it's whatever. The more I buy, the less it costs me, but it's going to cost me the salary of the clerks and everything else, whether I buy or not. That's the thing you run into, you see. And that's the situation, is you're dealing with a with industry sub-segments here that are peculiarly tailored to your purposes and don't, in general, have any other business that they can go to when you're not using them. So you pay them when you're not using them. Now, what you do is you give them other tasks to do. You make work that, not just for the sake of making work, but you keep assigning them tasks, so it's not that they sit on their hands. But the net result is that the drawdown from the Treasury at the end of 5 years is a hell of a lot more than you thought it was when you said, I ought to be able to buy this piece for this amount of dollars, and I ought to be able to buy this piece for this amount of dollars, including development.
That's where that minor expiration work came in, 67 period.
What do you mean by the minor expiration?
Still in the gap of the satisfied party about still retaining.
Well, what do you mean by the lunar expiration work?
Well, the rover, the Land Rover,
oh, well, no, that, well,
the same,
no, I don't think that was put in quite for that reason. That was put in because we were sort of looking at that time that obviously you wouldn't go to the moon once or twice or three times, and then we saw it as a indefinitely continuing program. But again, not one in which you would touch down and come back, but one in which you would build up your capabilities, not only with the kind of roving vehicle we have now, but you would build up in the Mark II, Mark III version so that you could stay not 3 days, but a week, and eventually 2 weeks, and this sort of thing. And then because you're going to stay 2 weeks, now you've got time to go very extensively. Therefore, you need a vehicle that can take you a long ways. Really built from a programmatic concept, not from just what do you do to keep these guys busy. It's very hard to ever put your finger on what is it that you're doing to just keep the guys busy versus what are you doing because you have a legitimate program desire, because these things will always merge back together. Guys say, well, that, you know, I know they're going to be capable in the design shop of putting some time. Let's have them work on this. I think this is something we'll want. Whereas if you're really cutting costs and could afford to do it, you'd simply say, well, I don't need them in the design shop. You find some other somebody else to pay their salaries, I'm not going to pay them and get them off the payroll. But we found we couldn't quite do that. So you got to pay them, so you look, and it kind of merges, and it's very difficult.